Hello and welcome to another episode of Paleocast, where we have the second half of our interview with Lars Holmer from the University of Uppsala telling us about brachiopods. I'm Laura.
And I'm Dave. And hopefully you enjoyed the first part of this interview in which we covered a bit about brachiopod anatomy and ecology. And this time we're going to be looking in more detail at their fossil record. So Laura, how have you been?
Yeah, pretty good. I've been doing a lot of work. I'm writing my thesis at the moment, so that's taking up almost all of my time.
Yeah, how's it going?
Yeah, it's going pretty good, I think. It's definitely a period of intense work, but it's good because a lot of other people who started their PhD at the same time as me in my department are also doing the same thing. So we're working hard together.
A lot of intense work, yep.
Yep.
I know how you feel. I've just basically finished 3 days worth of video editing from a recording of Pallas that we did
in December. Looking pretty good, the lunchtime lectures.
Yep, so we're releasing them on Facebook and Twitter using hashtag lunchtime lectures. So look out for those. They're on our website as well if you follow through to the live section and then to the Pallas Leeds meeting. And then we're highlighting one of them each day on our social media, which you can watch over lunch if you're in Greenwich Mean Time. If you're not, then you can watch them whenever.
They're about 15 minutes of
them. Yeah, so each talk is 15 minutes. The first two, I think, are 30 minutes, which were part of the first day symposium, but the rest are all 15 minutes. So it's nice, easy, nice 15-minute lecture at lunch. So.
And it's all new research, so that's really interesting.
Yeah, not even published about, so hot off the press, all the latest science. And then, otherwise, I've just been working on a super secret project, which...
The super secret project.
Yeah, which I can't tell you about, but that'll come in time. And I hope you should be excited for it, I think. Everyone get excited. Start asking the question. What is this super secret project? When can we find
Wait,
out?
Anticipation until it's released.
Yeah.
It is good. It's going to be good. Everybody should be excited about it.
Yeah, they should. But speaking of anticipation, I'm sure you're all chomping at the bit to hear the second part of this interview on brachiopods.
I was always thinking of writing the book when brachiopods ruled the world, but I doubt anyone would make a movie out of it.
So, when do we actually see the first brachiopods in the fossil record?
Extremely early. I mean, you know, problem, of course, like with the molecular trees is that it's a very controversial topic, the correlation of various sections and the dating of them. But it seems that they come in only slightly after the base of the Cambrian, which is now at 5.43 million years ago or something like that. And I guess, closing your eyes and thinking of a figure, I guess we are talking about maybe a bit less than 10 million years after that. So at, 530 million years ago, you start to find undoubted brachiopods. But before that, you have all these small shelly enigmatic sclerite thing that has been so... has interested Cambrian workers for such a long time. And of course, we think that some of them are related to the stem of the brachiopods.
Okay, so the first ones that we see, undisputed brachiopods, how are these different from the ones we see today, both in terms of morphology and paleoecology, what shape they were and how they lived?
Well, I mean, if you just look at them from from the basic, you know, they still have the same symmetry with a sort of larger and smaller shell, sort of upper and lower shell, if that is a correct anatomical orientation. And they also have a stalk. The earliest ones, we don't have soft parts preserved from, apart from the muscle imprint. We know what kind of muscles they have and what kind of sort of circulation system they had. And in many respects, they actually are more similar to some of the calcareous shell taxa today. But these actually have phosphatic shells. So this shell chemistry issue has always been very controversial. I mean, you know, is phosphatic more primitive? Is calcareous more primitive? I think maybe they evolved, you know, separately and maybe convergently in different directions with the shell chemistry. But that is quite a controversial issue. But basically, you would have, if you've seen a recent brachypod, you would recognize these first preserved brachypods as brachypods because they have the same type of muscles and circulation system and so on and so forth, and the same type of attachment.
Do you find any fossil taxa that really deviated from this kind of basic brachiopod body plan?
Yes, actually, before they suffered their major extinction in the Permian, you will find some of the weirdest, absolutely weirdest. It's like an Indian summer kind of flowering of the brachypod in one particular group, and they turn into sort of coral-like looking things. They live in coral reefs and look like corals, and they have all these weird shapes and lifestyles. Many of these were also free lying. They were sort of lying on the soft substrate, and that's a life habitat that has disappeared completely today. So whatever happened at the end of the Permian, it really hit this group and these types of lifestyles devastatingly. And of course, all reefs disappear. So obviously, the reef dwelling forms also disappear. So those are perhaps the weirdest morphologies that we've had in the brachypods. But of course, in the Cambrian, I mean, together with my Chinese colleagues, we've been looking at this soft body preservation in China, and there are some pretty weird morphologies there as well. And we think that you know, they may show what the earliest brachypods could have looked like.
And I think we'll get onto that later as well. So bringing it back to the Cambrian, how quickly did the diversity increase?
It's pretty quick. I mean, you know, from the first sort of, we call it Tomotian. I mean, the earliest brachypods are still known from Siberia during a time called the Tomotian, and that, you know, is, depending on who you ask, about 530 or something like that million years ago. And from that on, they go through quite a rapid diversification, and it's mainly the phosphatic groups. I mean, that's why I worked with these phosphatic groups in the early Paleozoic, because they quite rapidly become very, very diversified. So by the late early Cambrian and the middle Cambrian and upper Cambrian, you have quite a big diversity of, in particularly, the phosphatic groups that seem to have flourished with a quite wide range of morphologies and taxonomic diversity, and that then suffers a mass extinction at the end of the Cambrian, and then as you go into the sort of mid-late part of the Paleozoic, they are replaced by other taxa. But the first radiation really is in the phosphatic groups.
So when did they reach their peak diversity?
Yeah, sort of early mid Paleozoic. So Cambrian, Ordovician, and Silurian are the heyday for these earliest groups, and by towards the later part of the Paleozoic, it's mainly in the calcareous taxa, particularly these free-lying groups that I was talking about that turn into coral-looking things by by the end of the Paleozoic, they reach their highest diversity. So, for instance, if you go to this Gotland island that I talked about in the beginning, I mean, you can basically fill buckets with brachiopods almost at any locality. I have visions of bathtubs filled with brachiopods. That is one place where you could possibly go into that kind of fantasy.
Well, we'll leave your brachiopod fantasies out of this. What contributed to their decline then? I think I remember always being shown a graph of time versus diversity, and brachiopods start off high and go down, and bivalves start off low and go up. Was it a outcompeting of brachiopods by the bivalves?
I don't think so. I mean, like I said, I think the rise of the modern fauna, I think, kept their diversity low, but I think whatever caused the end Permian extinction wiped out this, particularly the enormously diversified free-lying taxa and the reef-dwelling forms and so on and so forth. So I think they were hit by the end Permian mass extinction and then never recovered. Mainly, perhaps because of the rise of the groups in the modern fauna, but it's of course very difficult to prove or disprove direct competition in this. But of course, Stephen Jay Gould, famously wrote a paper on this, calling brachiopods and bivalves ships that pass in the night, and I think he was probably correct. I don't think that they out-competed the brachiopods in any direct way.
Well, I think we got a pretty good understanding of what brachiopods have been doing throughout time. So if we look at what they can tell us about their environments, is there anything we can do, like with the chemistry of their shells, that tells us about their paleoclimates or something?
Absolutely. I've for a number of years, I worked together with geochemists looking at accumulation of rare earth elements in the shell, and also we've recently been down to Antarctica, and there, of course, also we use calcareous shell for getting this stable isotope carbon and so on and so forth for getting a grip on what went on in these Paleozoic seas. And of course, it's also useful to have these curves as an aid for correlating successions across the globe. There has been a debate on the amount of overprinting. I mean, whether if you should drill this or that part of the shell, and or if you should go for matrix and things like that. But they have been used. I can't. I'm not a geochemist, so I can't judge really what the most agreed on opinion are these days, but they are quite they have been quite useful. And these rare earth elements are quite interesting, because of course it can be used to compare similar values across the globe and see get a better grip on the what the adjacent continents were and so on and so forth. And so of course it's also measurement on the amount of input from volcanoes and so on and so forth.
How well do brachiopods preserve in the fossil record? Are they pretty good in calcareous rocks?
Absolutely. I mean, that's again why I choose to work with this phosphatic groups. They preserve extremely well and much, much better than the calcareous groups. They are almost, I mean, and I'm together with some British colleagues, I mean, we're able to prove that actually quite a bit of the original phosphatic structures are preserved even in shells as old as 530 million years old in the phosphatic ones. In the calcareous ones, it's a different matter. But recently, together with a colleague who's now in Plymouth, we were able to find original aragonitic shell preserved in shells from the island of Gotland again, so Silurian shells, and I think it still is the earliest record of aragonite actually being preserved. Of course, none of the recent brachiopods are aragonitic, which of course a more easy soluble calcareous substance, but it sometimes, if the environment is right, you can actually get this calcareous shell structures preserved.
So are lots of the calcareous brachiopods aragonitic?
No, not today, but they had a little sort of diversification event, particularly in the late Ordovician and Silurian, and some of them actually form reefs. You actually have brachiopod reefs on Gotland, and also in the UK you can find little sort of patch reef kind of they're not very big, but they are unique. It's the only time that they really form these massive shells. Like I said, in the Permian, they can also be part of reefs, but they are not actually reforming. These aragonitic extinct, mainly Silurian shells were actually monospecific, usually little patch reefs with very, very thick. They are among the largest brachiopods that have ever existed, and that is probably, again, that's why they are aragonitic, because it seems that the if you want to form really, really big shells, it's the same with the mollusks. If you want to form really, really big shell, it's sort of more energy. makes more sense to make your shell out of aragonite.
Does the aragonite normally, is it normally lost?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's very, very rapidly turns into something else, like calcite. But like I said, occasionally deep within the shell in this very pristine sedimentary environments. I mean, Gotland has not been subjected to any major kind of diagenetic event. No sort of mountain chains, or no tectonics. So they are pretty pristine. So sometimes you can find it, but it is lost very rapidly.
So your phosphatic brachiopods, your lingula, for example, if we use that, how would we ascertain whether or not we had some original phosphatic material?
Indeed, I mean, it's a matter of comparing them with the recent taxa, and actually it turns out that the difference between the two major genera today, Glotidia and Lingula, lies in the shell structure and the way the shell is formed. And my co-author, Sir Alwyn Williams from Glasgow, managed to trace this split very far back, possibly, even during the Paleozoic. Definitely there are some very, very well preserved structures that can be traced back through geologic time. Of course, they are affected by diagenesis and taphonomy, but looking at the recent shells, you can quite easily interpret the fossil shells and trace the way the shells were secreted way back in time, possibly even to the Cambrian.
So I've found a few lingula myself. They kind of look like fingernails, for want of a better analogy.
Yes, indeed.
And some of those have what looks like a pearlescent film on them. Can you actually see the original material, the original phosphatic? Would that look different if it had changed, or can you just tell by eye whether or not it's original?
I think these shiny shells are pretty close to what the original shell would have looked like. I mean, sometimes you can even see this faint color banding in even Ottovision lingolids. To my knowledge, I don't think anyone really has looked into that, but I think they are very, very well preserved. It's a fairly stable substance, and unless, you know, they are tectonized and subjected to big taphonomic processes, I think the phosphate preserves very well.
Right, so if we go back to your Chinese specimen that you mentioned, you recently published a paper looking at this organism, which has an agglutinated shell, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I think all these Chinese, I mean the Chenyang fauna, together with the slightly younger Guanshan fauna, there are two formations in China, that in south of China, that contains this soft border preservation. They've given us enormous amount of more information into the anatomy and morphology of the taxa that would otherwise not be preserved, because actually, if this form had been found in any other, like a normal limestone, you would not have found it, because it would have been completely soft probably. So I think they are very, very important for our understanding of how the brachypods arose. And of course, agglutination occurs quite commonly today as well, and in closely related forms, presumably the phoronids. I don't think they have a very well-known common name, but they are sort of, again, worm-like organisms with a lophophore, but a naked lophophore. That also very, very small group today, but they make a tube out of whatever material is present in the surrounding sediment, and that's called agglutination, of course. And the same seems to have happened in this 530 million year old sort of weird mixture of a phoronid worm and a brachypod.
So they kind of just stick bits to themselves, is that right?
Indeed. And I mean, I have to admit, that is something that we have to understand exactly. I mean, in most agglutinated forms today, I mean, the most common group today are various types of polychaetes, for instance. And they, of course, actively select grains and stick it onto the outside, which forms a tubes in a tube in which they live. Exactly how the phoronids do it is not quite clear to me from looking at the literature, but obviously they do it somehow. And I guess the lophophore could be involved. When it comes to these Chinese taxa, they seem to have had some kind of upper bivalve shell of some sort, which is also agglutinated. And exactly how the grains end up on this organism is still a problem to me. I actually don't understand that. I thought first that actually, because it's grains of silica, which of course can be secreted by organisms as well. But looking at the grains that actually are preserved on these organisms, it seems that they are detrital. I mean, they come from the surrounding sediment, and thus they somehow must be picked up and sort of attached to what must have been a sticky sort of mucus kind of lined exterior. But exactly how it is done is something I don't understand.
So the analogy I like to think of when considering agglutination is when you're in a nursery school or kindergarten and you make those little pictures using glue and glitter. So you draw the glue down, sprinkle glitter on, and then it sticks to the glue. If you covered your whole body in glue and then rolled about in some glitter, That's the agglutination process. Yes.
I guess, you know, in some way they must have done like it. But I mean, there are quartz grains in this. I mean, it's a shale, so it the amount of quartz is not enormous. But there are, we've seen that there are quartz grains around in some taxa. You can actually not these ones, but in other sort of you can actually see that they actively have removed all the grains from the surrounding sediment. We haven't seen that really in these Cambrian forms, but yes, regardless, they must have done like you say, cover themselves with sticky substance and then sprinkle grains over their surface.
And you said that the worms selected their grains.
Yes,
I like to think of that as them making a collage or a, making patterns or something. It's a bit more involved.
The most famous example are the so-called ice cream cone worms. They make very, very neat sort of ice cream cone shaped siliceous tube. But they of course can move around inside the tube, which these brachiopods cannot. Yes, it's an interesting problem and really one that I would like to look into more. We have these forms on the west coast of Sweden, and possibly we can start a little project looking at various types of agglutination. There is a small literature, but I mean it's not a very well studied topic.
Do we know how this group of brachiopods is related to the others? Do they represent kind of an agglutinated offshoot that didn't continue?
Well, I would think that they have something to do with the phoronids somehow, because I think they seem to have, I mean, we talked about the filtration that brachiopods carry out today, which is very specialized. I think maybe that this agglutinated forms had a more phoronid type filtration, whereby they actually direct the mouth and the central luffor towards the current, whatever filtration current. So the flow of food is directed towards the mouth. In the recent brachiopods, it comes from the sides and not towards the mouth. So my speculation, it's very difficult to prove, of course, but the way the tentacles of the luffophore is preserved in this Cambrian form makes me believe that it had a very different mode of filter feeding and more like that of the phoronids. And we still have phoronids, so in that respect, there is some kind of living, possibly closely related group.
Okay, so if you got these two branches, the phoronids and the brachiopods, and this Chinese specimen has got characters obviously shared with brachiopods and sort of similarities to the phoronids, does that infer that it's lower down on the branch of the brachiopod tree?
Yes, that would be my suggestion. But the problem is that, the molecular position in the molecular cladograms of the phoronids is extremely controversial. Some geneticists in the UK place phoronids within the brachiopod tree, so that phoronids then actually become derived brachiopods. Which is, it's possible. It's perfectly okay to lose characters. But more recent work seem again to put them back in their traditional place as a sister group to the brachiopods. And of course, this would make more sense, I think, with these Chinese forms. But it's fair to say that the discussions continue.
Definitely. So is that the biggest question left about brachiopods, is their family relationships? Is there anything else that we don't know?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the big problem. I don't understand why the protostomes, the mollusks and the annelids and the brachiopods and bryozoans and what have you, are so much more problematic to place in relation to each other as compared with the deuterostomes. I mean, of course, there are problems with the deuterostome branch as well, but there seem to be more problems with the protostome branch, and I don't actually understand why. So I think the topology of that entire branch is the big problem, really. I mean, how annelids very likely are related somehow to brachypods and foraminids, and of course to mollusks as well, and the interrelationship between those groups is very much a problem still.
Right, so to any budding paleontologist out there, could you sell brachiopods to them?
Oh, absolutely. They are the most green animal on the planet. I sell this to the students. You know, they don't consume much energy at all. They almost eat nothing. And, you know, they are extremely interesting type of adaptation. And we still don't understand how that adaptation came about. And they are some of the oldest animals still living on the Earth today. And, of course, Darwin spends an entire chapter on this, because he considered that a problem, of course, that they've retained this general type of morphology since, you know, half a billion year ago, and to understand that, I think is a very big should be of great interest. I mean, understanding the evolutionary patterns within all animals, I think is quite interesting.
Well, Laz, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So, Laura, I bet you'll never look at a brachiopod in the same way again.
No, I won't. I think they've got a lot of surprising diversity.
Do they? In what
respect? Yeah,
I
think
respect?
They do. Well, okay, so if you look at brachiopods in the modern, it's basically just like one tiny little blob that doesn't look particularly interesting. But in the fossil record, there's a huge diversity of brachiopods. They're really good for answering evolutionary questions because the fossil record in some places is really great. So you can actually see change in morphology in one species over time. So you can look at how a species actually evolved and answer lots of interesting questions about how evolution works using them. So they're a really good clade.
Would you ever eat one?
Not after hearing what you discussed.
Do you like eating bivalves?
No, I actually don't even like eating bivalves. So very unlikely to like eating a brachiopod. I don't get oysters. Or mussels. Don't really understand why anyone would want to eat them.
No, I don't think I eat any marine invertebrates, to be honest.
Do I? No, I don't think I like eating marine invertebrates as a general rule.
Decapods?
I like eating vertebrates. Vertebrates are tasty.
Tetrapods? Brilliant. I'll eat them all day.
And fish are pretty good too.
No.
I think is that a thing with paleontologists that, well, I suppose it doesn't work for me because I study tetrapods and like eating them, but I think a lot of...
You just don't like eating what you research.
Don't like eating their research. So I work with a lot of fish paleontologists who don't eat fish. Maybe it's a rule. If you're a paleontologist, email us and let us know. Do you eat your test clade?
Well, what would we do about dinosaur workers? Would they be
birds?
Birds, poultry.
Yeah, not into eating chicken.
Yeah, there's some food for thought. So I think that's a nice bit to round it off on. Me being incredibly funny. So make sure you tell all of your friends about this hilarious show on paleontology. And we'll see you again next time.
Bye.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
An extra question. Have you ever eaten a brachiopod?
No, no.